I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is RAG Radio. We come your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on Co-op Radio in Austin. Co-op is a community radio station. It's cooperatively run. It's solar-powered, and it's all volunteer. And it's a very, very cool place, and it's a pretty unique radio station. I don't think there's anything exactly like it in the country. RAG Radio is also syndicated. We're run on a number of other community radio stations around the country, and our podcasts also get wide distribution. This show will be up at least by the first of the week as a podcast. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. Tracy, how are you doing, sir?
Doing well. How you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Beautiful weather now. It's been storm time in Austin, Texas for a while. And boy, my hometown of Houston has been underwater. I mean, it's terrible, terrible, terrible storms and flooding down there. So, and they're still getting it.
Yeah, we're kind of lucky. It did rain pretty hard for us, but there was some worry. There's some worry there, but I think we're out of that, and it's like we're back to sunny days, or at least for a little while.
Okay, that's our weatherman, Tracy Schultz.
Giving you the play-by-play.
Giving us the report there. Good show, interesting show, fun show today. My guests are Tom Hayden and Barbara Williams, you know, we had a father-daughter show with Dan Rather and Robin Rather.
Right.
We've had a couple of shows. I don't know if we had a husband and wife show before, guys. but it's very cool. Tom, of course, has been our friend for many, many years. Was a moving force in the New Left in the 60s and has continued his work as a peace activist for many years. In fact, let me just give you the introduction here. Barbara Williams, also his wife, is a well-known actress, singer, and is the author of a new memoir, which we will discuss in a minute. Tom is in Austin as a featured guest at a three-day Vietnam War summit at the LBJ Library, where he is headlining a panel on the war at home. And he'll discuss that summit and maybe reflect a little bit on Vietnam and the anti-war movement. And he's also going to address his recent, surprising to many of his friends, endorsement of Hillary Clinton. Barbara Williams will talk about and read from her critically acclaimed book, The Hope in Leaving, a memoir. And we'll talk with her about other things. Tom directs the Peace and Justice Resource Center and publishes and edits the Democracy Journal. Tom served for 18 years in the California State Assembly and Senate, and his work frequently appears on the Raglog, and this is his fifth appearance on RAG Radio. A couple times we talked about the Port Huron Statement at its anniversary, and we also have done a couple shows with Carl Davidson talking about politics. So we've done some stuff. Barbara Williams is a Canadian-born musician and film, television, and stage actress. She starred in the blockbuster films Thief of Hearts and City of Hope and won a Canadian Emmy for Best Actress for the 1966 telepic Mother Trucker. On stage, she has played Amelia Earhart, Joan Baez, and Lady Macbeth. As a musician, she has performed in the United States and Canada, often in concerts devoted to peace, workers' rights, and the environment. I'll tell you that Barbara Williams and Tom Hayden, we're talking on the phone right now. They'll be in Austin, Texas, the first of next week. Barbara is going to be appearing at Book People on Monday, and Tom will be at the Vietnam War Summit. And then on Tuesday night, there's a RAG blog benefit event that they will both be at, as well as blues rocker Leanne Atherton. And we'll give you more details about that after a while. Barbara and Tom, welcome to RAG Radio.
Hey, Thorne.
Hi.
I talk a lot, don't I? Hey, it's great to, Tom, it's always good to talk to you, and Barbara, it's an honor to meet you.
Thank you.
So this is going to be a lot of fun, and I can't wait to see both of you in Austin. So, I mean, it's not exactly a road trip because you aren't actually going to be on roads, but a trip to Austin can't be all bad.
I'm looking forward to Austin. I have never been. Sorry to admit, but I'm really, really looking forward to. You know, it's a great music town, and And I can't wait to check it out.
Well, it's a place. It's a, you know, I mean, I've been here off and on since the 60s and since 63, and it's changed dramatically. It's now this incredibly fast growing sort of, you know, about 1 million people, I think, in the metropolitan area now. And it's growing a little too fast for its britches. and it's becoming, there's an affordability crisis and there are all kinds of things, but it's still a dynamic, fun city. So,
yeah, isn't it happening all over the world? I just got back from Vancouver and it's like, oh my gosh, I can't afford to live here now.
Well, Austin, it's been funny with Austin because over the years, it doesn't matter what decade it is. Everybody always said, well, Austin was wonderful 10 years ago. You know, it was idyllic. It was this, you know, it was heaven. It was the weird city. But now it's going bad. You know, now it's growing too fast. And so whether it was the 70s, 80s, 90s, people always said that. It was great before. But it's certainly got an appeal now because I think more than 100 people a day are moving to Austin. So anyway, it's Austin doesn't have the infrastructure to handle it. So there's all kinds of crises involved. But it's a very dynamic place and one of the real high-tech centers in the country right now. So okay. Barbara, let's talk a little bit about the memoir, and I think you're going to read us an excerpt as well.
Sure.
Boy, what a story your life is, and there's a terrific review of the book in the Globe and Mail, and they wrote, while the memoir market is constantly looking for the next big, near unbelievable story to astonish hungry readers, often the most affecting accounts of a life are those that are simple, unassuming, and relatable. Though on the surface, Canadian-born actress Barbara Williams, The Hope in Leaving, is a harrowing tale of poverty, tragedy, and familial dysfunction, it is never once written for high drama or shock value. In fact, the true poignancy of this notably understated book is just how normal these lives feel to those who have lived them. But it was a pretty crazy life you lived, and I, you know, to say rough and tumble or whatever would be understating it. You went through a whole lot with a schizophrenic brother and living in very serious poverty. A father who carried a beer inside of his coat jacket, and it sounds like it was an incredible struggle. And you for a long time wanted to leave. You wanted to pursue a career in theater, and how have you come to terms with all of that, and has the memoir writing it kind of helped you to do that?
Well, to begin with, I don't know anybody who really had a normal life, and you don't know what's normal,
right?
You know, until you start to compare. So, I think my background certainly made me self-sufficient, self-reliant in many ways. You know, my friend always says, Barb, we're industrial people. And it's kind of true, you know, when you grow up in that kind of hardscrabble way, you learn to take care of things by yourself. But there was a lot of tragedy in my life. And that's that was the painful part. And I have always been writing about it. I've always written journals. I actually started writing it. I was planning to work on a screenplay when I joined this writing class. But then the focus of the writing class was journal writing. And these stories just kept bubbling up. And when it came time to share them, that's when I really became very self-conscious. That was the most difficult ordeal, was when I was sharing the stories, I would be seized with dread, self-doubt. My hands would shake. I would be choked with emotion. And I realized how I'd always been keeping them inside. And, one of the things my teacher said really helped me. He said that, he quoted from St. Thomas. He said, if you keep what's inside, if you keep, no, he said, if you bring what's inside out, what you bring out will make you well. If you keep what's inside inside, it will destroy you. So I let that be my credo, to just let it all come out.
Right, right. Well, and you certainly did in this book, and it's, I mean, it's a remarkable passage. And I know that, you know, you went through some extreme hard times, a lot of poverty, you know. You start the book out with this chilling dream about you and your brother, and it sets the tone. But like the review said, it's all done in such a beautiful, clean, smart, understated way.
Well, I guess that's my voice, you know. In writing, I think it's important to show rather than tell. And in acting as well. I mean, as an actress, I know, you know, if you emote, it's not going to, people are not, if you're feeling for people, they're not going to feel it. If you just stay true to the text, to the subtext, then it's more authentically communicated, I think.
Right, right. And I want to talk about that in a minute too. I want to talk about acting. I did a little bit of it myself. I studied acting in New York, and it didn't end up being what I didn't end up doing that for a career. But it's very close to my heart. And a lot of people that I know went on to have sort of substantial careers. Why don't you go ahead? You were going to read us a little bit from the book. Do you want to do that now?
Yeah. Should I read something from the beginning, or maybe I'll read something? Let's see. I'm going to read from the beginning. Right. So I had this dream. It was a very disturbing dream about my brother. It begins on a day that I'm leaving. I'm ostensibly for a job in Toronto, but really to get away from my brother, who had been mentally ill for some years. And I had just decided it was, I had to think of myself. And then I went outside, and my car had been stolen. So this is where it picks up. Okay. By 5 a.m., I'm standing at an impound station on Skid Row, where my car was towed after it was found parked on a sidewalk, probably some teenage joyride, and I've done worse. But it's unfair that I have to pay the $90 to redeem it. The rain is still coming down. An old man, too long in his cups, is thrown up on the sidewalk, and I can't be sure he didn't splatter my sleeping bag, so I give it to him. He wanders away singing. I don't mind drunks. They're harmless, as long as they aren't raising you. We used to come here when I was little. It's my dad's turf, where he gets his logging work. Skid Row hotel bars are his hiring halls, since you have to be drunk to sign up for the kind of work he does. We would sit in the car outside darkened doorways while Dad ran in for just a minute. Then we'd wait for hours with scary faces leering in at us, skinny men with mashed-up noses and cuts over their eyes, and women with pasty skin and dark red lipstick smeared around rotting teeth. At closing time, they would slither by our car, cursing, crying, and hitting each other. Finally, Dad would stagger out, and we'd hold on tight for the blackout drive to wherever we happened to be living at the time. My guitar and suitcase are missing, the only things I was planning to take to Toronto. Everything else is here, just a little defiled. Everything but my windshield wipers that have been ripped off. Still pouring, and I can barely see as I start driving. I keep my windows down to reduce the fog, and I race to the ferry at an insanely reckless clip, bawling as much as the rain. I can see more the faster I go, speed making the water thin against the glass. On the ferry, I sequester myself by a starboard window for the comfort of a familiar view. My stomach is a twisted mess. Hot tea and food might help, but it's too much effort. I fix my eyes on the gray seascape and surrender to the storm. Disappointed tourists stare through the windows, hoping some errant orca might sail out of the gloom. Usually I love this trip. No matter the weather, I go out on the upper deck and breathe the best air in the world. Not that I've breathed the air in other places, but I know this air is the best. With my stomach still churning, I go outside and the rain soaks my clothes. The dream with Randy replays in my head. I'm sorry, he says. I'm sorry. Then the sun appears. The ferry whistle blows loud and long to announce our approach to Active Pass, and there's silence in our wake.
Wow.
That's terrific. The beginning.
Terrific. That's it. Is there a screenplay here?
You know, there could be. I'm holding on to the film rights. My agent in Canada has said there's been garnering a lot of interest. So.
Well, it sounds like it's definitely material for a film. It's pretty remarkable. Do you feel that, to what extent now have you dealt with and sort of pulled together the various aspects of your life? Do you feel pretty whole?
Yes, you know, there are some things you just realize that you will live with always. You know, you have that little bit of grief, but and you have to accept at some point that there's only so much you can do. You know, I lived for a long time wanting to change the lives of people in my family, hoping that, you know, they would see the light, or they would, you know, just on every level, I wanted to help them. And now I have a family of my own, and I just have to be grateful for everything I have and accept that I can't change.
Yeah,
I wish I could.
There's a point that comes where you realize that you aren't going to be able to change those folks and you aren't going to change what's already happened, and I guess you just have to sort of start making your own life work, I guess.
Yeah.
It's
still hard.
Yeah, it's not an easy process, and I know nothing like you've gone through, but I think we've all had these things that we all have our stories. My mother used to tell me when I was a little kid, she said, respect everyone because everybody has their story.
Exactly. In doing this, you know, I've just been, I've done several events now and been on a few panels. One panel, the theme was hope and determination. And, you know, it brought out all these people who are writing to heal things from their past. And just made me realize, yes, how everybody does have a story, you know. But another thing my writing teacher used to always say to me is to just put on your computer, your story is boring, because he always said what makes it special is the writing. So, you know, yes, everybody has a story. If you want to be a writer, you have to learn how to write.
Yeah, I guess that's pretty critical. So the response has been pretty positive to the book so far, right?
It's been very positive. I feel very blessed.
Okay, and you're going to be reading Monday at Book People in Austin, and then that's Monday evening, I think, at 7:00. And
yes.
Book People's a wonderful bookstore. It's
can't wait. Yeah.
It's a very cool bookstore. And then I believe you're going to have some books and be signing books, and we're going to talk along with Tom at the event Tuesday at the High Road on Dawson. So that's the Ragblog benefit. So this is all going to be great. We'll be back. We need to take a break. We'll be back, and we'll talk to both of you after this. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio.
Yes, Hope turns into hopelessness when the very good have stopped their quest. The very worst are called the best. Push that rock to the top of the hill. Falling down, and you push it still. Push that rock, it's all that you can do. When you know that rock is rolling back on you.
Support for Co-op comes from Polycot Associates, an Austin-based worker-owned web development cooperative. Polycot offers website and application development, integration, professional consulting, and design. More information at polycotassociates.com.
VSA Texas is a nonprofit organization that is an expert resource on inclusive art. We create and maintain an accessible and open community where everyone can participate. Our goal is to provide support and training to the public, enhance personal growth, and offer Texans access to the creative works of people with diverse abilities. To learn more about our programs and services, visit our website, www.vsatx.org.
More than yourself, it's who you know. Keep the fight, prove it isn't so. It's how you came, not how you go. Push that rock to the top of the hill.
All right, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio, and you were just listening to Barbara Williams. My guests are Barbara Williams and Tom Hayden, and I really didn't mean to sort of divide this into two shows. So, Tom, I want you to come in at any point. You can tell us something about, you know, what it's like. When did you write, Barbara? Well, first tell us about what we were just listening to. I'm sort of jumping around here, but what were we just listening to?
Oh, that song. Mm-hmm. That is a song I just I wrote a few years back. Was you know, about workers. I was, you know, I've been an advocate for workers' rights and. But it was, you know, it's based on the myth of Sisyphus, right? Pushing that rock, the notion that, you know, you keep pushing that rock, it's going to make you stronger.
Yeah, even though it is going to roll back down and you're going to have to push it up again.
That's what makes you stronger.
Really. It either makes you stronger or it destroys you,
or
I guess.
Or it crushes you.
Yeah. So, especially if you don't get out of the way when it's rolling back down. You have a beautiful voice, and I know you played. And Tom, please jump in at any point, and we'll be getting to you about and talk about Vietnam in a minute. But feel free to jump in and give us your perspective on any of this as we go along.
Oh, let me jump then.
We'll jump away.
Hi, Thorne again. Hi, Barbara Williams.
Hi, Tom Hayden. Tom and I are an unlikely team here.
The first thing I have to say that's simply a fact is that I'll be there with Barbara on Monday in Austin when she reads and performs. The second thing is that I'm in Austin because of the LBJ School Vietnam Summit at the university for a couple, 3 days. That features Dr. Kissinger, and it's heavily loaded with, you know, veterans of the hawkish brigades. But Marilyn Young and David Moranis and I will be on a panel about the anti-war movement on Wednesday, and the by the way, we will not be attending the dinner for Dr. Kissinger. Final thing I have to say is that I finished a book on the history of the anti-war movement. It's about the need to revive the anti-war movement and stop demonizing, marginalizing, and trying to put it down in the history of this country, because it was a great set of events that helped end the war and save many lives. The Barbara Lee, our peace congresswoman, outstanding here in California, has just introduced a resolution, a House resolution, calling on the Congress to vote in favor of a resolution that recognizes the importance and significance of the anti-war movement and its positive role in ending the war, and the need for more peace and reconciliation studies in university programs.
And it's, and that's very important, because as you pointed out, the anti-war movement has not gotten its due. It was one of the most significant popular uprisings in the history of this country, and it was in many ways very successful, even though it was also a very frustrating experience, one that I certainly lived through. Were you? How long have you two been married?
23 years.
23-ish. Wow. Almost 23, yeah.
Wow.
And we have a young man who is 16.
So you and both of you as writers, that's if writing is kind of an intense and in some ways very personal and lonely enterprise. How do you work together when you're both writing? And what is that experience like?
We just try to find extreme distance in the house. Tom has a room in one end and I have a room in the other.
Cool. Yeah. I know my father, who was a writer, would get up. He had a ritual. He would get up at a certain time, and he would put in a certain number of hours writing every day automatically. And I know different writers work differently. They have different kinds of disciplines. Some people just have to write when they're inspired, and some people just, whatever their state of mind, just have to sort of gut it out and get into the work. So there's lots of different.
Yeah, Tom, how would you describe your writing practice?
Participatory democracy put to a computer. In other words, everything's based on interviews and huge amounts of research to complement what I write from my own experience. I don't think I have anything to say except through my own experience. I write every day. And I've finished 19 books, and the next one is on Vietnam towards the end of the year.
Okay.
I'm, you know, Tom, of course, always has an agenda when he writes. Not that, you know, he knows where he's going all the time, but, you know, I'm a very different kind of writer, because obviously I write about my life, and it's very personal. I think, you know, we somehow complement each other. I've learned a lot from Tom just observing his discipline. And I was a student of his, actually, when we first met. I became a student because I was very interested in what he was teaching. That time he was teaching a class on religion and the environment. And I learned a lot from him. In fact, I subsequently wrote a screenplay that was based on the life of Hildegard de Bingen, who was one of the subjects of his course. Yes.
Okay,
Tom is the teacher.
Tom is the teacher. When you worked on this memoir, You know, I mean, one thing, it's one thing to be a disciplined writer, but it's another thing to be dredging up, or not dredging up, that's not a very good term, but
whatever,
these experiences that were very, many of them very traumatic, and then you're, the whole transformational aspects. Does that, I mean, are there emotional ramifications of that, I guess?
Oh, yes. I think that's why it took me so long to write it. This part of my story was distilled from a much longer book that took me almost to the present day, and the publishers decided to just make my first 24 years a complete book. But I had a lot of doubt about it. Obviously, I'm exposing my life and the life of my family and people that I know. So I had a lot of trepidation. And I had to keep coming to, you know, the classes I went to became a support group in many ways. Because I needed something to bounce off, and I needed validation and feedback and somewhere to go every week so that I would write.
May I say that Barbara's a far better writer than I am, because she is a creative writer and a lyricist, and she worked on her book for a very long time, because she chose every word, every sentence so carefully that you will be really struck by the lucidity and beauty of what she has to say and how she says it. I'm much more of a historian journalist and a lifetime activist, so I write through those experiences which are just, my writing is not comparable to Barbara's in its quality.
Barbara, what do you think your experience, what do you bring from your experience as an actress to the process of writing, especially in something like this?
Well, finding your voice. You know, every character I've ever played, the most important thing was to find the voice of that person, and it's not just a technical thing, it's sort of finding the soul and finding the love for that person. And the teacher that I worked with was also an actor and a poet, and his class was called method writing, writing from the deep voice. So it really did suit me. Because I think that, and I've always been like that. I've always been kind of a mimic. It's how I learned. So, I would just, listening to somebody and the pattern, the way they spoke, the rhythms, was always very important, as an actress and, obviously as a writer too. And in screenwriting, I've written a couple of screenplays.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
You wanted to be an actress from actually what point as a young girl?
I actually more wanted to be a singer. And then I never really felt like I was, I have a funny story about meeting Joni Mitchell when I was 15, and she completely shut me down because I thought, oh my God, she was so incredible. She sang sitting beside me on a bale of hay. but a teacher actually approached me.
Wish somebody had had cell phones then and got that on video.
Kidding. Yeah. It was at the Aldergrove Pop Festival, and I was picking strawberries. I was working, and we snuck out at night and went to this pop festival, and there was Joni. I was in a barn sitting beside this blonde woman, and somebody said, why don't you play something, Joni? And she played Both Sides Now, and we were like elbow to elbow, and It was so stunning. I'd never heard a voice like that. I'd never heard guitar played like that. So it was pretty amazing. But I continued. But I never thought I would have, you know, she just was it for me. But then a teacher asked me to be in a play. And it was at a very low point in my life. I'd had, you know, my brother was in an institution, and I'd suffered the consequences of some very self-destructive behavior. And so this play that he offered me was just kind of a dream come true, even though I didn't, you know, at first I thought, well, I don't know how to act, but then I knew I could. I knew it was just... I just connected so strongly, and then I ended up winning the Best Actress at the Provincial Drama Festival, which afforded me the opportunity to go to theater school.
Do you think that wanting to go, and we're going to finish out this segment, and then when we come back, we're going to talk with Tom.
Okay.
But this is so much fun, and Tom and I, we can always do another show and go in more depth into some of the issues, but this is a special opportunity to be able to talk to you. Do you think that wanting that the idea of being an actress and even a singer, because there's a lot of similarities. For one thing, you're often singing about other people's stories and other people's lives in song. Do you think that you're wanting to be a performer or an actress, which gives you an opportunity to live other people's lives? Did that sort of play a role in your need to escape your life situation?
Well, I think, yes.
Being able to become somebody else, you know?
Well, the first time I ever acted in front of an audience, I felt for the first time that I was being seen, even though I was hiding behind somebody else's words. But I was expressing my own emotions, and that to me was just like alchemy. It was such a beautiful experience for me, and I really felt, I understood then that I could do this. I could, if I could think it, I could become it, you know? It made me feel, it was very empowering. And, you know, then one thing led to another. I got to go to theater school, and then I got to join a theater company, and then, you know, and then my career kept blossoming.
Did you play Joan Baez? And I don't have it in front of me, but I remember reading that there was a review in Variety that I don't think this was their terminology, but they basically said you nailed it. What kind of experience was that? I would think that would be wonderful.
That was great. Well, it was also a learn, and that was one point. Tom can talk to this. Tom came, I think, every night, because I actually had these. What were they, Tom? Pineapple bombs that you'd.
Oh, the anti-personnel bombs from Vietnam.
Yeah, and so because it was, you know, about the student movement and Joan Baez, I opened it. I sort of provided the musical narration for the play, and I would hold these bombs that my friend Tom Hayden had given me. So it was kind of interesting, but that was one place where we kind of intersected our histories. Yeah. Or my fake history.
We're going to need to take a break after this, but had you did you have any involvement in political activism earlier in your life?
I was with a fairly political theater company in Vancouver. We were just always on the left, and you know, we were dealing with environmental things and land issues, workers' rights. But it wasn't really till I came down here, and then I started to see what was happening to the rainforest in my homeland, that I became active as an environmentalist.
Okay, we're going to take another break. We're talking with Barbara Williams and Tom Hayden, and I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Tracy Schultz.
Austin, and part of our service mission includes training volunteers in the art of radio broadcast. Each month, on the fourth Tuesday, Co-op holds volunteer orientations for those interested in getting involved in Co-op and learning how to broadcast. If you're interested in becoming a part of your community radio station, email volunteer at koop.org or call our offices at 512-472-1369 to sign up. Space is limited.
Austin Earth Day 2016 returns to the Browning Hangar at Miller on Saturday, April 23rd, noon to 7 p.m. Music from Asleep at the Wheel, Ruby Jane, Sweet Spirit, and more. Exhibits, kids' activities, and a variety of ways for your family to learn and celebrate the Earth. More info available at EarthDayAustin.com.
But some did a wonderful waltz, the wonderful.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. Barbara Williams and Tom Hayden are my guests. Barbara and Tom will both appear, headline a big event on Tuesday, April 26th. This is next Tuesday if you're listening live, from 7 to 10 p.m. at the High Road on Dawson in Austin near Barton Springs, near the corner of Barton Springs and Barton Springs Road and Dawson. They're both going to speak. Leanne Atherton is going to perform, the wonderful Leanne Atherton, and Barbara Williams, who we were just listening to right then, is also going to sing. And so this is going to be a lot of fun, and she's going to have her book, and she's going to be signing her book. So can't wait for it. That's open to the public. I want to go to Tom now. Briefly, I want you to say a little bit about the remembering the Vietnam War, because this event, this summit at the LBJ Library, is a part of what's being called a 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War. Although, I don't think the Vietnam War exactly started when people say it did. it's hard to say exactly when it started, but looking back at it, Tom, and it was such a the war was such a obviously transformative time in our country, and the opposition to the war was an incredible phenomenon. What do you see looking back on it? What are your feelings now?
Well, I'm very worried about the slant of historic analysis and propaganda that makes trivia of the anti-war movement, and even promotes the idea that, the United States could have won if we did this or we did that, or they didn't do this or that. We have recognitions for LGBT rights. We have Sojourner Truth and suffragettes on the new currency of the United States. We have African American museums. We have Native American museums in spite of the genocide, and so on. But there's never been any recognition of anything positive about the anti-war movement. So that's why I wrote the book, and I started a campaign with five or six colleagues, and it led to the Lee Resolution, which is an instrument for going district by district to get a petition signed. And you can be sure that the Republicans from Texas will be leading the charge against any sympathy for the anti-war movement, but we've always had those fights, and we always win in the end of history, but I'm very concerned about it.
All right. Go ahead.
No, that's it.
Well, you know, and it's so interesting that when you say, well, you know, that there are people who say if it maybe hadn't been for the public opposition that we might have won, what would winning have meant?
I don't know. That's what they said before it started.
Yeah.
That's what they said after it started. We've learned to understand we live in two or three different versions of the United States, and we're on the edge of civil strife, not civil war, of course, but civil strife. You can see it in the fringe base, which is a large base of the Donald Trump campaign.
Right, right. Okay, I want to talk about on April 12th, you wrote an article for The Nation. The headline was, "I used to support Bernie, but then I changed my mind." You say, "I have a variety of concerns about both candidates' campaigns, but I intend to vote for Hillary Clinton in the California primary for one fundamental reason," and we'll talk about what that reason is. I know this has gotten, the Nation article got phenomenal blowback. I mean, there's an incredible number of comments that are on that post. We've heard an amazing amount of blowback here. A lot of people feel that it's a betrayal. There's been, and you know, a lot of it has been very sort of strident, the reaction. I'm interested, one, in what your thinking was and in your decision, and two, what your reaction is to what the response has been.
Well, you know, it won't please Austin, but I feel completely comfortable with the Hillary base of the Democratic Party and the progressive movement. She did win 65.2% of the votes in Texas and got 147 delegates, and Bernie got only 33% and 75 delegates. And for me, it's only and always about race. I went to Texas in 1960 to marry Sandra Kaysen, who was then a white sit-in leader working out of the Y and the Christian community in Austin. It was the time of Ronnie Duggar, the time of Rob Berlidge at the Daily Texan. I was a very young man, and Texas is deep in my memories. To me, it's quite simple. When Clinton won Nevada, I could tell that she had a path to victory, and Bernie had a very difficult time ahead because his strategy, unintentionally perhaps, relies totally on white majority states and primaries and white majority caucuses. And I don't want to be part of an outcome that is at odds with the stated position of the Black Caucus and the Latino Caucus. And there'll be naysayers who say that, you know, that there's the millennial generation of Latinos and immigrant rights activists and African Americans. That is true, and I admire them, and I look forward to their leadership in years ahead. But for now, they are 25 to 35% of the vote, and they always have been and always will be. So why would I look at my lifetime friends when they tell me they're going for Hillary and somehow pontificate to them that they're just wrong? Is that my role as a white radical? I don't think so. They could be wrong, but I would share that with them in private and discuss it. It would never occur to me to, endorse a campaign that has been basically white since New Hampshire, and will continue to be the same. And we can go into many other details, but that's simply my reason. I'd rather be part of the Obama coalition of the Democratic Party pushing on from the outside and the inside than not. I have never been supportive of the Clintons on either war or on trade and neoliberalism, and I'm not likely to be at any time in the future. But somebody is going to win this, and the facts are that the denial has to begin to end. People have to sit down and figure out through proven consciousness raising and conflict resolution processes how to sort this out and get the best possible ticket and best possible platform.
Well, that's a question of process. But I think there's certainly larger issues than process. And you say that you don't, in terms of African-American people that you have been involved with in that movement for years, but also the anti-war movement, the roots, the whole phenomenon started with Occupy, the fact that the large movement that has been built upon then by Bernie Sanders about economic justice and the corruption of the political system in which we live in, especially due to campaign finance. People feel that there's a movement that's kind of like the movement that we experienced in the 60s, and there is an incredible mistrust. I think a visceral kind of mistrust on many people's part of Hillary Clinton. And it's not a question of who's going to win. It seems quite likely that Hillary's going to win, but that's a question of process. The larger question is what change is going to come about in the future, what role Bernie Sanders may play in the future. As far as I'm concerned, these are the issues. And he will come out of this as being an incredibly powerful figure in the Democratic Party and in the country. The one question, though, I wanted to ask, that your position on your history about foreign policy, your role, your role in fighting interventionist regime change kind of foreign policy, that it seems like, and that Hillary Clinton, with her history, in the Middle East, in Honduras, so much of it would almost disqualify her in your mind. It's almost like she. Who knows? She's obviously, moved to the left during the campaign. I don't know whether she might just move right back to the right. But it seems like, her speech at APEC, it seems like she Netanyahu could be her Secretary of State. I'm just voicing some of the things, Tom.
Yeah, you're just going on. I understand that. I agree
with that.
I already stipulated that I'm against her foreign policy and neoliberalism.
Yeah, but the question is, what would she actually do in office?
I don't know.
Okay.
I've always known that all politicians are the same in trying to secure more votes and more power for themselves, and what happens at the base determines what they're going to do. In this case, the anti-war movement has collapsed and has been in collapse for numerous years. Partly because of sectarianism, but also, for historic reasons. And unless the anti-war movement is rebuilt under a Clinton presidency, things will continue to go badly.
What do you think is the likelihood of that happening, Tom?
It's inevitable that the anti-war movement will come back because of the suffering and the likelihood of more terror attacks and so on. We've exhausted the cause, partly because of sectarian squabbling, and I'm not exaggerating. My next book will be on sectarianism, but it will come back because it will impose too much suffering on the world, will put the United States at a huge disadvantage in foreign policy, and will give rise to young people and rank-and-file Democrats led by people like Barbara Lee reconstituting its presence as soon as this election is over, hopefully by the spring at the latest.
Okay, do you... I guess, and Tom, I want to make it clear, I absolutely, one, I don't like the virulence, I don't like the stringent way that people are responding. I don't like the same thing that you don't like. I think that the fighting between the campaigns is counterproductive. It's coming from both sides, frankly, but... You know, I mean, I totally respect you. I respect you a lot, and I respect your right to support Hillary Clinton and to make decisions based upon, I think, intelligent premises, even if I disagree with what you're doing. So I want to make that clear. I mean, I was going on, but part of what I was trying to do is to voice a lot of what I'm hearing and a lot of what I see as a kind of larger picture about society in question right now of the working from the outside and working from the inside and whatever. And I think maybe we can talk a little bit more about this at the event on Tuesday. We can talk on another show if we want to, because it's just a really important question right now in our society.
Thorne, can
Let
I just...
Let me remind yeah. you, oh. if I can.
Uh-huh. We have 2 minutes.
I just wanted to interject one thing.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to say that Tom and I are, I am a Bernie supporter, and Tom and I are coexisting very peacefully on this. So I'm not going to elaborate.
So it can be done.
It can be done, and okay. I think it's very important that okay. everybody gets that message.
Cool.
If I may say,
yeah.
Bernie and his PR people have been spinning their imminent victory in these primaries after going through 7 wins, well-deserved, in largely white primaries and caucuses. When we came to New York, he had a rally of historic proportion. He continually predicted victory in New York, and he was beaten really badly. He lost 58-22. Hillary won 75% of the African-American vote. Hillary won 65 or more of the Latino and Puerto Rican vote. Hillary won the vast majority of women and union households. And that is exactly the composite nature of the Progressive Democratic Party base. Whether it's misled by leaders or politicians,
do you think that's the Democratic Party?
Question, but that's a fact, and people okay. really, really have to dwell on that.
Okay,
they're in denial now.
Well, do you think that's the base right now? We have 30 seconds. We can't go any further, really. But it seems like the base of the Democratic Party is changing dramatically, too.
Oh, I agree totally with that.
Yeah.
I take that into account. I mean, I supported Obama against Hillary because I thought a new base was coming.
Tom, we've got to stop.
The left departed from Obama, and now it's just been demonstrated firmly that the broad progressive base of the Democratic Party supports Hillary Clinton and not Bernie Sanders. His okay. base is primarily white.
Tom, we're out of time.
Okay.
And we'll continue this. Maybe I would like to do a show just to talk about this. I think there's a lot of questions that we can pursue. Tom and Barbara will be at an event next Tuesday at a Ragblog benefit, and that'll be fun. And you can find out more information by going to the Ragblog. Paul Buell, who is going to be our guest next week, is now that's going to be a week later. So I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio.